From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Passed a near complete ban on abortion care. What that means is that physicians are fearful of facing criminal penalty for providing necessary health care for their patients.
Doctors in Alabama could soon face life in prison for performing abortions after Alabama's governor signed a law effectively banning abortion in the state. We'll go to Huntsville to speak to one of the last doctors performing abortions in Alabama. Then we look at what a post-Roe America could look like. Then President Trump proposes overhauling the nation's immigration system to favor high-skilled workers over immigrants who have family ties to the United States.
Democrats are proposing open borders, lower wages, and frankly, lawless chaos. We are proposing an immigration plan that puts the jobs, wages, and safety of American workers first.
We'll speak with two leading immigrants' rights activists who face possible deportation due to their activism. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump has unveiled plans for a new so-called merit-based immigration system that would prioritize highly skilled and English-speaking workers while further restricting asylum seekers and immigrants who have family living in the United States. Trump announced his plan in the White House Rose Garden Thursday.
My plan expedites relief for legitimate asylum seekers by screening out the meritless claims. If you have a proper claim, you will quickly be admitted. If you don't, you will promptly be returned home.
Many lawmakers called Trump's immigration plan short on specifics and a non-starter. This is Washington State Democratic Congressmember Pramila Jayapal.
It does not include any protections for Dreamers. It does not include any plan for the 11 million undocumented immigrants that are in this country that need a path to citizenship. It undermines the family immigration system that has been the cornerstone of our country's immigration policy.
This comes as Senator Lindsey Graham has introduced a bill that would deny people the right to seek asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border, forcing them instead to take their claims to U.S. consulates in their home countries, even if their lives are in danger. Senator Graham's bill would also increase the number of days migrant children could be detained to 100, five times the current limit. We'll have more on immigration later in the broadcast. The Guardian's reporting a top Iranian general recently met with Iraqi militias in Baghdad and told them to, quote, prepare for proxy war with the United States. The push by the leader of Iran's Quds Force came as the Pentagon reportedly drew up a plan to send as many as 120,000 troops to the Middle East if President Trump decides to take military action against Iran. This comes as the New York Times reports President Trump has clashed with his cabinet and advisors in recent days over whether to attack Iran. The Times cited an unnamed Trump official who said Trump poked fun at his national security advisor, John Bolton, in a recent meeting with the words, "If it was up to John, we'd be in four wars now." In Yemen, rescue workers pulled a bloodied young girl from the rubble of her home in Sana'a Thursday after an airstrike by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition killed both her parents and all four of her siblings. The latest Saudi-led strikes came as UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, warned 4 years of U.S.-backed Saudi attack on Yemen has left at least 7,300 children killed or seriously injured. This is UNICEF's executive director, Henrietta Fore.
Each day, another 8 children will be killed, injured, or recruited to the fighting. And every 10 minutes, another child will die from a preventable cause. Like a lack of food, with 360,000 children suffering from severe acute malnutrition. In fact, half of the children under 5 years old in Yemen, there are 2.5 million children, are stunted. And stunting, as you know, is irreversible. Yemen is a test of our humanity. And right now, we are badly failing this test.
Police arrested four activists Thursday inside the Venezuelan embassy after they spent weeks occupying the building at the invitation of Venezuela's government in order to prevent it from being taken over by Venezuela's U.S.-backed opposition. The Venezuelan government criticized the arrests, calling them a violation of the Vienna Treaty of 1961, which protects diplomatic missions around the world. This is Code Pink activist Tig Berry.
If the embassy in Washington, D.C. is taken, what says that the embassy in Venezuela can't be, the American embassy in Venezuela can't be taken, which sets a pretext for war?
Last month, Democracy Now! Went inside the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. To see our coverage, you can go to democracynow.org. In Brazil, tens of thousands of students, teachers, researchers rallied in cities across Brazil to protest government cuts to education. Far-right President Jair Bolsonaro's promise to slash funding to federal universities by about $1.8 billion while freezing thousands of postgraduate scholarships. This is Sao Paulo student protester Vanya Cristina.
With these cuts to federal university funding, we must make noise. People need to show the importance of science and education. As we are saying, there is money for the militia, but not for education. People will fight for education.
In Mexico, police said Thursday they discovered the body of journalist Francisco Romero outside a bar in the Caribbean coastal city of Playa del Carmen. Romero's body reportedly showed signs of repeated blows and a gunshot wound, making him the sixth Mexican journalist to be murdered this year. Romero previously worked for a Facebook news page where two other journalists, Ruben Pat and Jose Guadalupe, were murdered last year. In Nashville, Tennessee, 68-year-old prisoner Don Johnson was killed Thursday evening by the state after prison officials strapped him to a gurney and injected him with a lethal chemical cocktail of three drugs. After the execution, Johnson's lawyer told reporters she believes the gurgling, gasping noises he made as he died showed he suffered excruciating pain. Meanwhile, the state of Alabama executed 41-year-old prisoner Michael Brandon Samra by lethal injection Thursday. Samra was sentenced to death for his role in a quadruple murder in 1997 when he was 19 years old. The execution was carried out around 7 p.m. just after the Republican governor, Kay Ivey, denied Samra's request for a reprieve. The denial came just one day after the governor, who calls herself pro-life, signed a near-total ban on abortion into law. The U.S. Senate has confirmed Louisiana lawyer Wendy Vitter as a federal district court judge. Vitter's spoken frequently at anti-abortion rallies and has worked for years to defund Planned Parenthood. She once told the New Orleans Clarion Herald Planned Parenthood, quote, kills over 150,000 females a year, unquote. Vitter has also falsely linked abortions to cancer. In New York City, newly revealed text messages show a police commander shrugged off news about the death of African-American Staten Island resident Eric Garner in 2014 at the hands of a fellow officer as, quote, not a big deal. The revelation Thursday came during an NYPD disciplinary hearing for Officer Daniel Pantaleo, who killed Garner by putting him in a chokehold and refusing to let go, even as Garner gasped, I can't breathe, 11 times. A text message exchange between officers just after Garner's death showed Police Lieutenant Christopher Bannon was warned Garner had no pulse and was most likely DOA or dead on arrival. The commander responded, not a big deal, and we were effecting a lawful arrest. Officer Daniel Pantaleo never faced criminal prosecution but has remained on the police force. He could lose his job if found guilty of violating NYPD procedures, which ban the use of chokeholds. The father of U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin has completed the most expensive purchase of a living artist's work in U.S. history. Robert Mnuchin purchased Jeff Koons' 3-foot-tall metallic sculpture titled Rabbit with an $80 million bid Wednesday, though he paid over $91 million after Christie's auction house fees and taxes were added in. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has proposed redefining how the government calculates the poverty line using a different measure of inflation. Economists warn the switch to the so-called chained consumer price index would underestimate the impact of inflation on wages, gradually chipping away at benefits like food stamps, Medicaid, and health care subsidies for millions of Americans. New York State environmentalists are celebrating after Governor Andrew Cuomo blocked the construction of a $1 billion Williams Pipeline project, which would have carried frack gas from Pennsylvania's shale fields under New York Harbor. The decision came after New York's environmental agency ruled the pipeline threatened water quality with mercury and other toxic chemicals and would endanger marine life. And a federal judge in Virginia has sent U.S. Army whistleblower Chelsea Manning back to prison after she refused a second subpoena ordering her to testify to a grand jury. The order came just 1 week after Manning was freed after spending 62 days behind bars for refusing to testify about her leak of hundreds of thousands of secret State Department and Pentagon documents to WikiLeaks, including evidence of U.S. war crimes. This is Chelsea Manning speaking just before she was taken into federal custody once again.
Jails and prisons exist as a dark institution, and despite that, it doesn't frighten me or disturb me. I mean, I've already been to jail, I've already been to prison, so attempting to coerce me with a grand jury subpoena is just not going to work.
Manning faces up to 18 additional months in prison and could be fined up to $1,000 a day while she refuses to testify. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The assault on reproductive rights continues to ratchet up as legislatures and Republican governors around the country pass increasingly restrictive abortion laws. On Wednesday, Alabama Governor Kay Ivey signed the nation's most restrictive abortion ban into law, effectively banning the procedure, except in cases where a pregnant person's life is at serious risk. The law does not make exceptions in cases of rape or incest, and doctors could face up to life in prison for performing abortions. Last week, Georgia enacted a law banning abortion when a fetal heartbeat can be detected, which often occurs at around 6 weeks into pregnancy before many people even realize they're pregnant. Similar bills have also been passed in Iowa, Kentucky, North Dakota, Ohio, and Mississippi. Just yesterday, Missouri's Republican-led Senate passed a bill banning abortions at 8 weeks of pregnancy. Reproductive rights groups are challenging these laws in court. For now, the bans have either been blocked or have not yet gone into effect. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi responded to the abortion ban in Alabama Thursday and warned the country is heading down a dangerous path.
At the same time, have been dismantling and sabotaging and continuing their attacks on health care. And now for women specifically, as we have seen in Alabama, heartbreaking and unconstitutional assault on basic reproductive freedoms. It's really, I don't want to be a fearmonger, but I do believe that they're trying to go on a path that will totally dismantle Roe v. Wade. And we have to be vigilant and express our concerns on this legislatively and at the grassroots level.
The architects and supporters of the bills are actually welcoming a court battle in the hopes the fight will land in the Supreme Court and lead to the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the landmark 1973 Supreme Court ruling that recognizes the constitutional right to an abortion. For more, we go to Huntsville, Alabama, where we're joined by Dr. Yashika Robinson. Dr. Robinson is the medical director of the Alabama Women's Center for Reproductive Alternatives, one of the only three clinics left in Alabama that offer patients abortion services. She is one of only two abortion providers living and working in Alabama. Under the new Alabama law, she could spend the rest of her life in prison for doing her job. Dr. Yashika Robinson, welcome to Democracy Now! Thank you so much for taking this time out of your busy schedule. First, respond to the passage of the almost total abortion ban in Alabama.
Well, thank you for having me. With the passage of the near-total ban on abortion here in Alabama, the initial response has just been very disheartening. I've seen many patients that have expressed anger, a lot of concern about how this is going to affect access to care. And as a provider, I'm very concerned about how this will affect the care that I'm able to provide for my patients.
How will it accept it? Now, it has not gone into effect. It would be 6 months, and it's obviously going to be challenged in court. Talk about, I mean, right now, If this were next year and the ban were in effect, right, Governor Ivey has signed off on it, you could go to jail for the rest of your life for performing the procedure.
Yes, that means that I will have to choose between my freedom and staying out of jail and doing what's best for my patients. And that is going to be something that will make it more difficult for physicians to choose to come to this area. Alabama is an area that already have a lack of physicians and lack of resources as far as care for patients. We already have women that are traveling further and further to access the care that they need. And with the fear of criminal prosecution, there's no incentive for women or physicians who provide women's health care to come to this area. There is no physician that would want to have to choose between their own freedom and doing what's best for the patient. From our standpoint, it puts us in a catch-22. If we conform to the law and abide by the law, we could still be faced with litigation from patients and their families if they are harmed. This would put us in a situation where we could be forced to let patients get near death, get very sick or ill, and potentially be harmed before we could proceed comfortably with doing what's best for women. With that being said, the exception for health reasons is not adequate. It's not appropriate when it comes to abortion access.
Would you perform abortions anyway if this law were put into effect in Alabama?
Well, as a women's health provider, I understand how important abortion access is. I'm going to always conform to the law. So with that being said, I may be forced to travel to other areas to provide care for patients. But my hope would be that we can change the law to be sure that women continue to have access here in Alabama. Because otherwise, that means I will have to travel to be sure that women have access and to be able to continue to practice my trade and do what I feel so strongly is necessary for women. And that means that women will have to travel further and further. We already have patients that don't have an abortion clinic in their area. We have patients that are driving 6 and 8 hours to get to us now. So if Alabama continues to go down this path, it is going to place another obstacle in the way of women. And we already face so many obstacles when it comes to health care here in the South.
I wanted to turn to Alabama Democratic State Senator Vivian Figures, one of just four women in the Alabama State Senate, confronting Republican Senator Clyde Chambliss on the state Senate floor as lawmakers debated the bill.
Do you know what it's like to be raped?
No, ma'am, I don't.
Do you know what it's like to have a relative commit incest on you?
On me? No, ma'am.
Yes, on you. Okay. So that's one of those traumas that a person experiences, just like that child experienced. And to take that choice away from that person who had such a traumatic act committed against them, to be left with the residue of that person, if you will, to have to bring that child into this world and be reminded of that every single day.
Alabama State Senator Figures also introduced an amendment that would criminalize vasectomies, arguing there are no laws regulating men's bodies. It was defeated. But talk about this, Dr. Yashika Robinson, that this abortion ban was passed with no exception for rape or incest.
First of all, her words and just asking the other representative about how he would feel, or does he know what that feels like. She tried to bring it home, to bring a human aspect to it, and I appreciate that. And his response, saying that he didn't know what it was like, but still it was very clear that he was in support of this bill, was very troubling. As a as an abortion provider, I understand that there are so many personal and medical reasons that go into why women choose abortion. And there is no way that we can know all of the personal things that are complicating a woman's life and that's affecting that decision, just as this senator said. But for him to still be in support of the bill, I feel like that was... It was like an insult on women, an insult on healthcare. It was very clear that it didn't matter to them how this affected women. The only thing that was important was them achieving their political agenda. And it's just sad for women in Alabama. It's very sad.
I mean, you face more time in prison than a rapist. You would face life in prison, 99 years in prison, Dr. Robinson.
Yes. And it's the only thing that I can say is just really, for me as a provider, it causes a lot of anger. When you look at other areas of medicine, there is no other area of medicine where we have legislation like this that threatens the physician with criminal prosecution for simply doing their job. There's no other area of medicine that is regulated in such a way. And then to have physicians to potentially be penalized with more time in prison than even a rapist is appalling. It's simply appalling. And we know that this is not about what's best for women. It's more about our representatives and their personal moral objection to abortion care.
Dr. Yashika Robinson, can you describe your day? I mean, you spend a lot of time delivering babies as an obstetrician gynecologist.
Yes, I made the decision that I wanted to be a women's health provider. And what that means is that I have a commitment to taking care of women throughout their pregnancies. I deliver babies, I provide prenatal care, but I do understand that pregnant women, they will choose to have deliveries, and sometimes they may have to make the decision that that pregnancy will have to end in an abortion. And I understand that that is just part of healthcare and one of the essential services that women will need, and I respect that decision. And I'm happy to be with women no matter and be supportive of them no matter what that decision is for their pregnancy.
Can you talk about the protests you face outside your clinic? How difficult is that for the women going inside, making some very difficult decisions?
We already know that sometimes for women, making the decision to have an abortion can be very difficult. They've already wrestled with this prior to even presenting to our clinic. And then for their decision to be questioned once again, for them to be judged when they come in for care that they know is necessary for them at the time, it's just something that women shouldn't face. And with me being someone who also take care of women throughout their pregnancy, just because of other people's objection to abortion care and the fact that I am willing to take care of women here in the South in whatever way they need, my patients who come to the general obstetrics and gynecological practice, they are also faced with the same harassment. I mean, I have women who come in at 8 and 9 months pregnant who have protesters screaming and yelling at them. That should never happen. You know, it makes me think of a story where I had a young lady who came in. She was pregnant. She was in her third trimester. She came in just for a routine prenatal visit. And unfortunately, at the time that we evaluated her, we found that she had already had a fetal demise. Her baby had already died in utero. This was a very desired pregnancy. And even that young lady, as she left to go to the hospital, knowing that she would deliver that day and that her baby was no longer alive, she still faced the same harassment.
I wanted to talk.
I understand.
To you about, you know, I'm talking about you facing life in prison for performing abortions if the ban went into effect, but also facing the endangerment of your own life. In this country, a number of doctors and health practitioners have been killed for providing abortion. Do you fear for your own life, for your family's life?
I mean, I think about my safety and I take necessary precautions as much as I can. But if I'm focused more on fear of harm to myself, I can't be focused on my patients in the way that I need. And, you know, in medicine, it is so important that you keep your head in the game, that you're focused on the person that's in front of you. We have to make split-second decisions all the time. And so I try my very best not to be distracted by that. I am a very spiritual person. I pray. I believe that the work that I'm doing is I believe that I'm here because I feel that God put me here for a reason, because there are so many women that need me. And so because I understand that I'm doing work that I am supposed to be doing, I feel that I'm going to be protected. And if there comes the day that I am harmed because of it, it's a decision and a sacrifice that I know is necessary. And I guess I've just made the decision that I'm willing to accept that.
You've made a lot of very remarkable decisions in your own life. Can you talk about growing up in Alabama, having your kids at a very young age, and how you fought to get an education and become a doctor?
Yes, I come from a background, a very humble background. I did have my first son prior to finishing high school. Being a teen mother was part of my motivation for going into obstetrics and gynecology. There are so many women here in the South that face very similar situations. The teen pregnancy rate here is very high. I understand that education is one of those things that will help to bring us out of the poverty that can sometimes be associated with becoming a mom so early. And I felt that women in similar situations needed to see someone that comes from a background just like theirs, who has been able to come out of that, to continue to achieve goals, to not be ashamed of the decisions that we've made, and just to be motivated by that. Because it is so easy for people to tell you, you can do it. But if they see someone that looks like them, that comes from where they have come from, that has been able to do it also, I think that gives them extra motivation.
So you had two children when you were still in your teens, your two boys. Can you talk about then deciding, what made you decide to go into medicine?
Well, one of the main things that motivated me was that when you become pregnant early in life, a lot of people tend to talk down to you. I experienced a lot of criticism and negative comments. And it was just important for me to be able to show them that you know, the decision that I made early on, the circumstances of my life don't really dictate what I can do. And I also wanted to be able to, I wanted my children to not be ashamed of the fact that I did become a mom so early. There's a lot of things that go into why young ladies in some situations like mine end up pregnant early on. And
well, Dr. Yashica Robinson, in the state Senate, when this bill was passed, it was 25 white men who passed this bill. Can you talk about the impact of this on women in Alabama, but particularly on women of color like yourself?
Well, the impact of it is that it's going, we know that legislation like this affect women of color and those women from lower socioeconomic status the most. We know that those that have means will always have access to the care that they need. And so the patients that I serve, those are going to be the ones that are most affected by this decision. And then to see that the representatives that voted in favor of this, none of them looked like us. None of them represented us. It was all men, none of whom will ever know what it's like to carry a pregnancy or to have to make the hard decision to end a pregnancy. None of them were people of color that even know some of the things that we go through coming from a background where you don't always have the finances that you need for just basic things in life, and how that can really play a part in you having to make the decision not to have another baby. And just looking at the picture of those that voted for this bill was enough to cause outrage for women, and especially women of color.
According to CDC, Alabama has one of the highest infant mortality rates in the country. It recorded 7.4 infant deaths per 1,000 live births in 2017, the fifth highest rate in the U.S. The national average is like 5.8 deaths per 1,000. The year before, Alabama had the country's worst infant mortality rate, with 9.1 deaths per 1,000 live births. The significance of this, Dr. Robinson.
Well, Alabama have so many things that we can address to make things better for women and babies. We have a very high maternal and infant mortality rate. And a lot of that goes into, a lot of that stems from the fact that women do not have access to the health care that they need. Many patients are not able to access health care or even obtain insurance until they become pregnant. Many women will only qualify for Medicaid during their pregnancies. And as a physician, I know that optimizing their health prior to pregnancy would be best for both the patient and for her baby. Conditions that, you know, would be easy for you to understand. It's like patients that have hypertension and diabetes. If we could optimize those things prior to a pregnancy, then we would have better outcomes when it comes to, as it relates to maternal and infant health. However, we have lawmakers that are focused on placing more restrictions on women's access to health care, as opposed to focusing on ways to make access better.
Your final thoughts, speaking to us from Alabama, the state that might be the really the testing ground for what happens at the Supreme Court, the idea that this essentially a virtual ban on all abortion could make its way to the Supreme Court and possibly, in the climate of the Supreme Court, overturn Roe v. Wade, that it started in Alabama. Your thoughts, Dr. Yashica Robinson, as one of only two Alabama-based doctors who are performing abortion right now.
My thoughts is, you know, Alabama, when it comes to the things that are really important, we can be last at so many things. Like you said, our infant mortality rate, our maternal mortality rate, our cervical cancer rates are very high. And this is the one thing that we want to be first in. It's not something that we want to brag about. You know, my desire is to live in a society where women have access to the care that they need, where even insurance covers women for abortion care, and that having access to the care, to health care, essential health care, is not based off your zip code. And so I just still remain hopeful and just hope that as we move forward, that we can look to do what's best for women and that we can achieve that ideal society.
Dr. Yashika Robinson, we thank you so much for spending this time with us. Dr. Robinson is the medical director of the Alabama Women's Center for Reproductive Alternatives, one of only three clinics left in Alabama that offer patients abortion services. Be safe. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, people talk about what would a post-Roe country look like. Well, many abortion providers, women's rights activists say, actually in many parts of the country, it looks like what's happening today around the country, even when Roe v. Wade is legal. Stay with us.
I'm my rose keeper every chance I can.
Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. That is Ani DiFranco. Play God. I'm Amy Goodman. Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer issued what many considered a dire warning from the bench this week, implying Roe v. Wade, the landmark ruling that recognizes the constitutional right to an abortion, is in danger. He wrote the comments in a dissent for an unrelated case in which the court voted to overturn a 40-year-old precedent. Breyer wrote, quote, "Today's decision can only cause one to wonder which cases the court will overrule next," unquote. I want to turn now to a quote from an unknown author that's gone viral on the internet after it was shared on social media by feminist icon Gloria Steinem. It reads, quote, "I want any young men who buy a gun to be treated like young women who seek an abortion. Think about it. A mandatory 48 hours waiting period, written permission from a parent or a judge, a note from a doctor proving that he understands what he's about to do, time spent watching a video on individual and mass murders, traveling hundreds of miles at his own expense to the nearest gun shop, and walking through protesters holding photos of loved ones killed by guns, protester who call him a murderer. After all, it makes more sense to do this for young men seeking guns than for young women seeking an abortion. No young woman needing reproductive freedom has ever murdered a room full of strangers," the quote goes. Well, we turn now to look at what a post-Roe America would look like and how many people are already cut off from abortion access across the country. In Minneapolis, we're joined by freelance journalist author Robin Marty. Her most recent book, Handbook for a Post-Roe America, also co-author of the forthcoming book, The End of Roe v. Wade, Inside the Rights Plan to Destroy Legal Abortion. It's great to have you with us, Robin. This idea of continually saying, what would a post-Roe America look like? You have pointed out it looks like many jurisdictions in America today.
Thanks so much for having me on, Amy. And as Dr. Robinson had just mentioned in her own segment, what she's seen in Alabama is the fact that there are already people who are traveling 6 to 8 hours just to come to her clinic in order to access care. That is what America looks like right now. And for many people, you can say that abortion is legal, but it is so inaccessible for them that they might as well be living in a place where they just are not having legal abortions.
So can you take us through, you know, right now people seem to be shocked by what has now just happened, this onslaught of fierce anti-choice bans, abortion bans around the country. But you have shown in Handbook for a Post-Roe America and all your work at Rewire and other places that the groundwork has been laid for years.
Yes. Obviously, ever since the beginning of Roe being decided, the anti-abortion movement has always been trying to overturn it. But it got very enthusiastic about it just after the 2010 election, when they were able to sweep a number of states and make them Republican strongholds. And through that, they were able to pass a number of model legislations that came through places like Americans United for Life, National Right to Life Committee. And these bills were all very small, incremental steps that were meant to try and take a challenge up to the Supreme Court to let them review Roe v. Wade. Back in 2011, we were seeing more things that were like 20-week abortion bans or extending waiting periods to 48 or 72 hours, very incremental changes, because at that point, the anti-abortion movement wasn't sure whether or not the court would actually overturn Roe. And so they just wanted to make small changes so that they didn't accidentally set off a case that would make a precedent that would make Roe stronger. That all changed after 2016. Once there were more appointments to the Supreme Court, and especially once Justice Kavanaugh replaced Justice Anthony Kennedy, who was considered the swing vote, then it was all systems go. No longer were people worried that they might accidentally uphold Roe, and that's why we have this new onslaught of heartbeat bans, of total abortion bans, and things that are very obviously unconstitutional. These bills were all being introduced back in 2011, 2012, 2013. It's just that they were not passing because at that time, they were being opposed by anti-abortion activists themselves as well. Now, anti-abortion activists are the ones who are enthusiastically supporting heartbeat bans or supporting total abortion bans. And that's how things have switched over the last 10 years.
Talk about states where abortion is effectively banned or will be soon. Like, talk about the legislation Missouri just passed.
Yes. So Missouri is in the process of passing their own heartbeat ban. It's very slightly different from the other ones that we've seen in that it has an extra 2-week window on it. So the idea is that abortion may not be banned until about 8 weeks after last menstrual period. So that would be about 4 weeks after a person would realize that they were pregnant. However, in Missouri, that's really not an additional window because Missouri only has one abortion clinic in the entire state, and that is in St. Louis. In Missouri, it's also a 72-hour wait in between visiting the clinic the first time and then visiting the clinic the second time. You have to wait 72 hours in between, and often, because of the way that abortions are scheduled, you will end up waiting a week in between your first appointment and your second appointment. On top of that, you have the wait that you would need to actually be able to access an abortion appointment in the first place. When you add these layers upon layers of roadblocks, then you've made abortion significantly impossible to obtain. And so you've effectively outlawed it within that state, even though technically Roe is still intact and abortion is still legal.
How many states have only one women's health clinic that provides abortion, Robin?
I believe at this point we are at 7 states that have just one clinic. We have North Dakota, South Dakota, Missouri, Wyoming, West Virginia, Mississippi, and I probably just missed one, but I'm pretty sure there are 7 at this point. Arkansas sometimes, but there is one clinic that does provide medication abortion, but they only have one place that offers both medication and non-medication.
And yet abortion is still legal in all 50 states.
technically, abortion is legal in all 50 states. It's just very, very difficult for any person to access it, but especially any person who lives outside of these large cities where the abortion clinics are there. And one of the things that people aren't very clear about is that even in states where access is considered slightly better, maybe there are 2, 3, 4 abortion clinics in that state, often they are all located in the same city or in the same 2 cities. So in essence, it's just as hard for a person to get in because they will still have to travel. They'll still have to do their waiting periods. They still have all of these roadblocks that they have to get through. And so they might as well just have one clinic.
Well, Robin Marty, I want to thank you so much for being with us. We're going to get back to you soon. Freelance journalist, author of Handbook for a Post-Roe America, co-author of the forthcoming book, The End of Roe v. Wade, Inside the Rights Plan to Destroy Legal Abortion. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we're talking immigration and the threats to activists around deportation. Stay with us.
Obsesionado con mi boca. Habla sin respirar, despacio te digo, porque nos falta un tiempo más para pasear este país nublado, este país nublado. Para pasear este país nublado, este país nublado. And
País Nublado by Helado Negro. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump's unveiled plans for a new so-called merit-based immigration system that would prioritize highly skilled English-speaking workers while further restricting asylum seekers and immigrants who have family living in the United States. Trump announced his plan in the White House Rose Garden Thursday.
As a result of our broken rules, the annual green card flow is mostly low-wage and low-skilled. Newcomers compete for jobs against the most vulnerable Americans and put pressure on our social safety net and generous welfare programs. Only 12% of legal immigrants are selected based on skill or based on merit.
Although no legislative details for the plan have been revealed, Trump's proposal is likely to hit a wall in Congress where the democratically led House has repeatedly clashed with Trump over immigration policy. This is Democratic Congress member Pramila Jayapal of Washington State responding to Trump's plan.
It does not include any protections for Dreamers. It does not include any plan for the 11 million undocumented immigrants that are in this country that need a path to citizenship. It undermines the family immigration system that has been the cornerstone of our country's immigration policy. And it sort of assumes that only one high-skilled set of workers are what the country needs, when we know that the country desperately needs workers of all skill levels. So it's not a plan. It is another attempt to fund a vanity wall.
Trump's immigration proposal comes shortly after the administration purged top officials of the Department of Homeland Security in recent weeks, reportedly as part of a plan led by advisor Stephen Miller to steer the country towards even more hardline immigration policies. For more, we're joined by two prominent, outspoken immigration activists who are fighting against their own deportations. Joining us in our New York studio, though she's usually based in Seattle, Washington, is Marumora Villalpando, an activist with La Resistencia, the resistance, and the group Mejente. ICE moved to deport her last year, even as her green card application is still pending, specifically noting her, quote, extensive involvement in anti-ICE protests and Latino advocacy programs, and that she had, quote, become a public figure. She's now part of a free speech lawsuit that aims to protect immigrants like herself. Also with us, Ravi Ragbir is back, executive director of the New Sanctuary Coalition here in New York. Last month, the federal appeals court ruled in favor of Ragbir in his own free speech case, saying the First Amendment bars ICE from targeting activists for deportation based on their political speech. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Let me start by asking Maru about this so-called proposal that Trump worked on with his son-in-law, the New York developer Jared Kushner, who is also working on a Middle East peace plan, but to come up with immigration. Republicans as well as Democrats slammed it, saying there is very little there, and it doesn't deal with, as Pramila Jayapal said, issues of the 11 million undocumented immigrants in this country, DACA, people on the border, family separation.
Well, it's another white supremacist take on immigration. We're not surprised of this. But let's remember that actually bills in Congress in the past, since 2007, have included a tier system, a merit system. So it's not brand new. But what they're doing is going even harder on our communities. I think it's just another step towards this war on immigrants. Although there might be some congressional people saying that they're against these basics of a plan, we have seen that even Democrats have recently approved a bigger budget for ICE. ICE keeps asking for more money, and they keep giving them money. I think that it's important to realize that what they're presenting has been there before. The problem that I see is that it could actually somehow become true, since so much money has been given already to ICE, and we have seen that those hard lines that they are setting up could be somehow implemented regardless of what Congress do.
And Ravi Ragbir.
So he talks about merit base. It's a his hypocrisy because he himself is not merit to be in the office he's in right now. But if you look at the larger scope of it, it is part of his plan when we talk about stopping migration from specific countries. Countries that don't have the resources because they have been raped by Americans taking away their resources so that they don't have the education process to have this higher skill level of people who can migrate and who want to migrate. So it is deliberate. It is also the fact that he didn't look at the 11 million is that he will now be able to focus on them to remove them. You know, I talk about ethnic cleansing that this administration is focused on. So it is a deliberate aspect of that plan. Also remember that his daughter and his son-in-law has been selling visas to people from other parts of the world, right? So if you're looking at merit base and you look at this, it's all about the Benjamins, baby, as Representative Omar said. It's all about the Benjamins.
And when you say selling visas, you mean people paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to get a visa. They put money into a development project, for example, and then they're given a green card.
Correct. So if you look at the investment visa, the EB-1 visa, I believe it's called, they have been that's a million-dollar industry if you look at what it is and how it is implemented. And then if you look at the merit base and high-skilled workers, they can add a lot more to that. So I am seeing this as a deliberate, even though they look at it as an immigration aspect, it is also deliberate about the money that they can make through this process.
Ravi, talk about your own case. You've been fighting deportation for years. You know, we were, Democracy Now! Was there when you were taken into custody, when you were held, you were released. But you've just won a free speech case. Explain what happened.
So the court has recognized that there was retaliation against me and that they took me to custody and was implementing my deportation because of the things I've said and the things I've highlighted. You know, I just mentioned that this is about the money that not only the president's family is going to make out of this. I speak openly about how harshly this agency is. You know, they even quoted some of the directors saying that Ravi has talked about being that the ICE is like Nazis and we are moving towards a dark period in history where history is repeating itself. They don't like that because they know that it is true, but they also want to avoid the publicity. So the case actually recognized that the retaliation was evident, but it wasn't just about the free speech. It is about the fact that the jurisdiction stripping of Congress 1252G, which takes away the jurisdiction of the courts to adjudicate cases like this. They have said that the free speech trumps that 1252G. So it's on its, on that alone, it's a huge victory, and many people are wondering, what does it mean now?
And Maru, ICE moved to deport you last year, even as your green card application still pending, specifically noting, quote, extensive involvement in anti-ICE protests and Latino advocacy programs, and that you, quote, became a public figure. You, too, are now part of a free speech lawsuit.
Yes, we filed a lawsuit in behalf of La Resistencia and the Coalition of Anti-Racist Whites that is based in Washington State. They're a group that support our work. And our lawsuit, what we argue, is the chilling effect that this retaliation has in our groups. Not only that, we have to invest now the little capacity and resources that we have to fight the detention of people in Washington State and their deportation. Now, some of those resources have to be used to keep me in the country. But also, when this retaliation comes against our freedom of speech, it does create a chilling effect on those that are part of our groups or want to be part of our groups. And so we have seen people in our groups that have to step back because they're afraid they're going to be next. So that's basically what we're arguing, is that the government needs to stop this retaliation against political dissidents, because it does trumps in everything else that people want to be involved. It does create this level of fear that is actually working in some instances, where people that wanted to be public or wanted to support our work somehow, now they feel that they shouldn't because they could be next.
In Vermont, another key free speech case filed in 2018 by the farm worker organizing group Migrant Justice argues ICE unlawfully surveilled, harassed, arrested and detained their leading members. This is Zuly Palacios speaking on Democracy Now! A few years ago.
I am sure that they sought me out because of the work I am doing to defend human rights and not for anything else, because they, what they wanted to do was get into the community and intimidate us that way, but they're not going to succeed. We will never stop defending human rights.
That's Zuly Palacios in Vermont. Maru, talk about what's happening now with you. How often do you have to go to court? Do you fear every time that you will be deported? When we were covering Ravi, he was just going for a routine check-in when they took him.
Yeah, we never know. Even when we go to court or when we go and do actions, we never know if ICE is going to decide to put me in detention. Last April 30th, I had another court date. It was a master hearing. This is the third master hearing I've had. We did an application. My daughter is a U.S. citizen. So last year when she turned 21, she submitted an application for me. We're still waiting to hear what's happening to that application. As a matter of fact, the day of my court date, we got the government requesting even more evidence we have already submitted.
Do you think you would improve your chances if you just stopped your activism?
Probably I would have, but I've done this work not because I want a green card. I do this work because I want everybody to stay in the country and don't have to go through what we've seen families have to go through. If I had been quiet, I probably would have had the green card a long time ago. But that's not the reason, again, why I do this work.
And Ravi Ragbir, where does your case stand now?
We're not sure what is going to happen, whether the government is going to appeal this. And the only
How long have you lived here?
I've lived here over just under 30 years.
30
decades. I have a U.S. citizen daughter, U.S. citizen wife. I would actually like to also mention that even the administration doesn't want to give green cards. So I will say that the system has been backlogged to stop even processing of green cards of people who don't want to, who don't speak up. So this, we have to challenge that. We also, and I may make take time to mention that it is not only immigration activists, but Scott Warren, whose case is going to be heard on, he's going to go on trial very soon. We need to stand up against that because he's an activist and who has done work trying to protect people on the border. In terms of my case, we don't know we are waiting for the government to either figure out whether they're appealing or allowing it to go back down to the district. We are waiting for that over the next 30 days to see what happens.
Your reference to Scott Warren, an activist, leaving water in the desert so migrants won't die.
Correct.
In the desert along the border. We want to thank you both for being with us. Ravi Raghbir, immigrants' rights activist, executive director of the New Sanctuary Coalition, and Marumora Vijayapandlo, activist with the group La Resistencia and Mi Gente. They're both fighting deportation after being targeted for their activism. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.